Okay, so here we go. Parsha Shoftim. I want to share with you. First of all, we're going to learn tonight. Le'iloi Nishmas Chaya Bas Aaron Yehuda, Harold's mother-in-law. Her neshama should have an aliyah. It's the first yard site. Okay, I want. Okay, so I want to share with you an idea tonight by Rabbi Riskin. I think it's a fascinating idea, which I think it comes from Rabbi Riskin's like unique position as someone in Israel and seeing, you know, how the Israeli army works up front and up close and personal. So he discusses the ethics of the Israeli army. And it's like one of those ironic things that there's probably no army in the world that holds itself to a higher standard. And there's probably no army in the world that is condemned for all of the things that they do. So the question is, what's what's the source of the ethics of the Israeli army? So I think that the ethics of the Israeli army largely comes from this week's parsha. Yes, it's kind of, I don't know if the Israeli army sat there and delved into Parsha Shoftim as much as it's part of like the collective conscience of the Jewish people. And so that's kind of, you know, the starting point tonight. So despite the best efforts of the Israeli army, its PR is often not so great and it gets beat up. But I'd like to try to understand a little bit more what the expectations are when one goes out to war, not from a Tzahal standpoint, but from a, I don't want to say halachic because we don't do halachic here, but from a, perhaps a hashkafic, you know, aspect. How does that really look? So Rashi says at the beginning, it's on the pasuk of ki teitze la machana oivecha. So he says samach hakotav yitziyah milchama lekan lo mar lecha she'ein mechusar eiver yotzel milchama. So Rashi says what's the connection, right? The pasuk right before in Parak, at the end of Parak Yotet is Shein tachat shein, ayin tachas ayin. Like, what does that have to do with going out to war? So he says, lo omar lecha shein mechusar eiver yotzi lemilchama. Now, you should know that a person that's missing a limb doesn't go out to war. Okay, fine. So Rashi, though, says, davar acher.
Maybe that's where he lost
the limb. Right. Could be. So Rashi, in this way, you don't lose it twice. Like, once you've given to your country, once you're good. So he says, davar acher, lo omar lecha. So he says that if you do mishpat tzedek, if you're just and you do the right thing, so you're guaranteed that you're going to be successful at war. Fine. Rashi says it's important that when you go out to war, you should realize that you're going up against your enemy because really, they're your enemy. And if you think that they're not your enemy, and you have rachmanis on them, in the end, it's going to bite you because they're not your friends, they don't want to be your friends, and they're never going to be your friends. Fine. So I think that that's an interesting way to paint the beginning of going out to war, is the notion that when we go out to war, we go out mishpat tzedek. There's a certain unique quality to the way we go out to war that we go out in a way of doing.
Is this referring to one of the two types of wars that are permitted?
So we're actually going to get to that in the very next, like in the very next source. But yeah, that's a good question. Okay, sorry. So the pasuk then continues. This is actually now pasuk yud. So we're going 10 pasuk in the head. If you're going to go out to war, you're right, you're about to lay siege to the city, you have to call out in peace. Okay, so we see that actually Shaul does that right before he goes out to Amalek. He like makes some sort of overtures of peace. It doesn't work. He goes out to war. Moshe does that by Sichon. Moshe does that by Og. He says, I don't need to fight you. I'm not, there's no reason to fight you. And yet they go out to war. Moshe says, fine, you want to go out to war, we'll fight. So Rashi says, so to David's point, when it says ki tikrav el ir, what kind of war are we talking about? So we're talking about a war of milchemes reshus. So milchemes reshus is, you don't have to fight the war. So let's say David HaMelech does that to expand the borders of Israel. He pushes out eastward and maybe northward also, and he goes down to Edom also. When he does that, it's not the biblical boundaries of Israel, but he's saying, listen, there's nothing wrong with making the empire bigger. So that's a milchemes reshus.
So doesn't that like contradict the notion of your enemy is out there and it should be by mishpat? It doesn't seem like I want more land and I declare you my enemy and I
don't have. So if you read the psukim going on, yeah. Right? Let's just read pasuk Yud Aleph. So Yud Aleph says Vayayim Shalom Tancha. What happens if the people say we're happy to make peace with you? All they have to do is they pay taxes and tribute to you. So it's not a high expectation, meaning we could make peace. What does peace look like? I don't bother you. You pay me taxes. But that's the way of the world. It's interesting. I know that, like, you know, whatever Navi I'm reading, like, paints, like, my perspective on things. So right now, whatever, like I'm probably not going to finish Yeshaya in time for the school year, but whatever, we'll binge read Yeshaya over the next 2 weeks. But so Assyria was fascinating. Assyria did not want to do anything other than collect taxes. When they attacked you, they didn't care about religion. You do whatever you want. You want to be Jewish, that's great. You want to be Assyrian, that's great. All they wanted to do was, like, feed the economic machine that was the Assyrian Empire. So that's why, like, the craziest thing is that Chizkiyahu's father, Ahaz, gets taken over by Assyria, and he goes and makes peace with them, and then he goes up and visits them in Assyria, and he's like, whoa, he brings some of these idols back to Israel with him. And the whole thing is so crazy, because you sit there and say, like, nobody asked him to do that. So there's different kinds of being taken over. So here, you know, you want to make the empire greater. You maybe want to have the money to, like, do whatever you got to do. So that's not inconsistent with, like, the world at the time. But you don't have to go and kill all the people, right? The karate la'el shalom. You have the option to call after peace. So that's Rashi's take on it. Milchemes reshus akos of medaber. But take a look at the Ramban. So the Ramban says, במלחמת הרשות הכתוב מדבר, כמו שבמפורש, בניין כן תעשה לכל ערים הרחוקות ממך מאוד. Right, so Rashi's basis for it is, in Pasuk Tetvav, it says, this is what you're going to do to all your distant enemies. So, כתב הרב זב מספרי, ששנו שם, כלשון הזה, במלחמת הרשות הכתוב מדבר, והכוונה לרבותינו בכתוב הזה, אינה אלא לומר שפרשה בסופה תחלק בין שם מלחמות. About Kriyat HaShalom, right? So what he's saying is, that's just at the end. The idea that, you know, this is how you can deal with, like, faraway people versus close people. But he says, the thing is, about Kriyat HaShalom, afilu b'milchemes mitzvah. He says that when it comes to, like, reaching out to make peace, he says that's even by milchemes mitzvah. Right? When I have, like, a mitzvah to destroy the local people, I even there have to call out in peace. Even to the local people in Canaan, you had to ask them for peace. Moshe calls out to Sichon. We often forget that Sichon Amori is one of the seven nations. And yet, Moshe calls out to him. And he says that doesn't go against the idea that you have to destroy them and you don't let anybody leave. The difference is that when it's one of the faraway countries, what happens if they don't want to make peace? So you only hit the males when you're going far away. The Ataf is Harim, right? Hanashim v'Ataf v'Zochrim. Harim, But when it comes to the locals, right, if you reach out to the Canaanim and say, hey, brother, right, from, you know, Sham, we're like distant cousins, like, let's make peace. And they say, no, we're not making peace with you. So then you have to kill everyone. Nobody's allowed to live. But if they're willing to make peace, then we embrace them and we are peaceful with them. So that's the Ramban. So the Ramban is fascinating because this is not something that we generally are, you know, used to. We usually think that when it comes to the idea of the Shiva Amimim, you come in and you kill them. There's like nothing to talk about. And then it becomes like, I always felt uncomfortable teaching that like to my students, especially if there was like a non-Jewish person in the classroom, because like, how do you sit there and justify that? Like, what? Like, we come into the land of Israel and we kill all the local people, men, women, and children. And then like, they look at you and you're like, and they're like, so doesn't that sound like a lot like the Nazis? And you're like,
it's more like the
So like the whole notion, it's
what
like
the Arabs it, trying to do, right? Or what the Arabs are trying to do.
Right. So it's a very uncomfortable one, and I don't think there's a very good answer. But the Ramban actually, to me, paints it in a much better light. What he says is, you come to all these people and you say, "Listen, we don't want to fight. We come in peace. So if you're peaceful and you pay,
come in peace to take you over. It's still not great. It's
right, but the narrative sounds so much better.
Oh yeah.
No. I mean, I would much rather if, like...
Might makes right. This is what this is saying. That's all. I'm stronger than you. Either I kill you, or you pay me not to kill you. But I'm taking it. You didn't write this stuff. It's okay. It's not your fault. It's all right. It's not your job to...
Oh, no. The stuff that's within there is non. It was really in the Jews to begin with. Just to be...
Right, meaning it would have been much better if God would have just brought like some cataclysmic event like the Makos to the land of Canaan, preferably right before we come in, and then we come in, we're like, I don't know, we didn't do this, right? Like, whatever.
You're giving us an unoccupied land.
That would have been better.
Why did he have to
make
did
people
have to occupy land? There was plenty of land to go around.
Yeah. I'm not defending it. I think I agree with everyone. I think that's where it gets complicated.
Yes,
but
right.
But in the world of war, which was like, this is what the land of Israel is probably one of the most fought and sought pieces of property on the globe.
Yeah.
Because for a long time, before like the world spread out, like, it was the hub of the world. And if, you know, like, if all there was really was, like, parts of Asia and Africa and a little bit of Europe, so Egypt was a mighty power, Assyria, Babylonia, and Aram were big powers, and they were always north of Israel, and Egypt was south of Israel. So it was like, go up, go down, go up, go down. Even before the Jews were even there, the Plishtim, right, the original Palestinians, right, the Philistines, they go down, they fight Egypt. Egypt kicks them out, they fight. Like, this is all they do. So the land of Israel is constantly fought over. So the fact that it's a fought over land is fine, but, like, to me, I kind of feel a little bit better saying, like, we weren't destroyers, but we were, I don't want to use the word occupiers, because
yeah,
that's, like, wrong context, but that was probably the most suitable word, but we did what, like, everybody else did. You conquered a piece of land, and you said to the people, we're not killing you, just pay taxes. And so long as you behave and do what you got to do, we're all going to be happy and we could coexist. Sadly, that has been something that's plagued the world for quite some time. So that's Rashi versus the Ramban. I have to say I'm much happier with the Ramban's interpretation because, to me, it just, I don't know, sounds a little bit nicer. And maybe that's not how it's supposed to be. Maybe war shouldn't be so nice, and maybe that's what it is. I mean, somebody once explained that the way you understand the way the Canaanim are and the way Amalek is that, like, I don't know if it's a great answer, but, like, God forbid if someone has like a tumor or something like that, and you were to watch and see the doctor with the knife cutting open the body, you would understand that like that's a necessary thing that has to happen to make the person better. But if you didn't know what was going on and you just saw someone, you know, with a knife cutting into a person, you'd be screaming, how could you do that? So there was something that we had to cut out of the spiritual realm of the world, and the Kananim were pretty bad people and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I don't... Well, I mean, the Kananim were... Did they not feel that way?
Oh. I don't think that explanation would
have... Yeah, I don't think it would sit well, like, in the world of the Kananim. Yeah, I hear that. But they're... I don't know, like, why you... They certainly were morally depraved, but yeah, I don't know. It's not a great answer. I don't know. Whatever. Anyhow, move it along. Pasuk Yud Bet. Vimlo tashlimimah. But what happens if they say, we don't want to make peace with you? So you go out to war and you lay siege to their cities. And when you take over the land, what do? You kill all the males. Obviously, why do you kill all the males? Yeah, because they're the people back in the ancient civilization that were going to destroy you. In fact, if you look through Tanakh, there's a couple times where there's a war, and who's the hero or the heroine? It's a woman. Why is it so perfect that the woman is the heroine? Because you don't see that coming. Like, when Yael takes in Sisra, like, you don't see that. Like, I mean, we know the story, so we know how it's going to end every year. We're like, oh, gee, how stupid can he be, right? But yeah, like, Sisra went to sleep. Perhaps there is the, you know, midrashically we talk about how Sisra first slept with Yael first. Should anyway give you like a certain sense of where he's at. But Sisra thought he was like being protected by this like sweet lady, like nothing's gonna happen. There's another story. It's I think by Avimelech, one of the Shoftim. Right? He goes into this. He's like by the wall of the city, and what happens? Some woman throws this massive piece of metal. She like drops it on his head from above. Like, why is it doing that? Because that's where you least expect it to come from. So you kill all the males. The women, the children, and the animals you'll take. You'll eat the spoils of your enemy. That's what you do for faraway places. Which are not from your local non-Jewish people. Good so far? I mean, we're not really good, but all right, we're going to accept these psukim as for what they are. So it gets a little bit like dicey in Ted Zion. So the cities of the nations that you live among, that God gives you the land as a nachala, don't let anyone live. You have a mitzvah to wipe out the nations of Chet, Amori, Knani, Prizi, Chivi, and Yevusi, like God commanded you. Why do you have to do that? Because they're bad people, and they're going to teach you to do bad things. All right, so I think, to me, the first question was, what does it mean to make shalom, right? The karate lele shalom. We have the machlokas, Rashi, and Ramban, whether it's reaching out to everyone or just to, like, the milchemes rishos. But then, I think, to me, the next question is, what do I do, right, with pasuk tetzayin? Karate l'shalom is pasuk yod. You have to make peace. And now in pasuk tet zayin, we're told, no, you don't make peace. What do? Completely obliterate them. Lo techayek kol neshama. You can't let one soul live. And according to the Ramban, that means so far as you kill men, women, and children. Nobody lives. So how does that go? Yeah, but like from an ethical perspective, meaning like, don't know. I had a friend, like, she's still a friend. I have a friend who at some point in his life was like a real big Kahana guy. Not that like we were like really Kahana guys, because I think he died when we were in high school. But he would like read all of his stuff. And like he would tell me to read this, I don't know, like I didn't have a stomach for it. Like it just like didn't do it for me. But one of the things that he did say was like, he wasn't saying you kill the Arabs. What was he saying? Like, bring them to the border. Right, like you know, you drive them on Egged buses, chartered, air conditioned and all. And right, when you drop them at the border and be like, all right, don't come back. To me, like, from an ethical standpoint, like, I would be much more comfortable with that. Like, you conquered all of, like, the other side of the land. Don't give it to Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi, Sheva, Menashe, but turn to all these people and say, listen, we're offering you, anybody that wants, you can fight, okay? If it's going to come down to war, people will die, but when the war is over and we're the winners, whoever is still living, we will walk you to the border and you'll never come back again. And then, by the way, they won't be a what? They won't have any impact on you morally and spiritually because they're not there. Yeah, Steve, you're about to say.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not how it works. You know, you're going to win or come back.
And if you're strong, and if your army is good, they're not going to come back.
It's a little lot of international pressure, but
So I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I assume that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. But back then, you didn't have to worry about it. Why? Because on the other side of the Jordan River, there was a lot of empty land. Still empty land.
So what does it say about us that in order to maintain our spirituality, we have to massacre everyone? Because God forbid, if anyone's left, we're not strong enough in our faith or belief that we won't turn astray. It seems just not the greatest message that the only way for us is to maintain our spirituality is by killing people.
Well, right. I think the message is not so much you to kill them. The message is that to maintain spirituality back then was much harder.
It's like a really big ghetto.
Right, because like the...
But also there, you're talking to a group of people that this is the reality. You don't say, Hashem wasn't saying this is the best and the brightest, and these are all Abraham Avinu's, and everyone can stand on their own. Saying this is the reality of people.
Right. I mean, I think the reality is like that's true, and on top of that, I think like back then, like to be monotheistic was really hard. Right. Like nowadays, like I don't know, like how many people are left on the planet that aren't like really monotheistic? It's just a lot of them.
Yeah, all right.
Fair.
Buddhists, everyone who's coming into the land, either they're couple people who are. By the way, they're living in trouble in the last 4 years.
Right.
No reference there, like immunity,
I'll say
immunity, or
strength. Right. So they are like new to the thing. But even if they become like more like rooted in it, like nowadays, okay, let's assume that Christianity is monotheistic. I know that it's like not all like poskim will tell you that, but let's assume that they are, and Muslims also. Like you've just like hit almost half the planet. Like, there's a lot of people that think somewhat similarly to us. Like, back then, like, nobody believed in that stuff. Like, you needed to believe in a God that was, like, tangible. It was really, really, really hard to be monotheistic. So I think, in light of that, like, it's hard. But that said, I still think, like, I would feel much more comfortable, like, with, like, the Meir Kahana approach. Like, drive them to the border. We don't want to see you again. Plenty of land elsewhere. And the world was a lot less populated back then. So, like...
I think it's just very good. I think both tokens are needed. Because the first you have the arts are about God of Disneyland, not essentially arts as still as a gem of the Jews. Then you have the land that is promised to the land where all of the seven nations are in the six nations control. So for those six nations, you have to get them out. You have to wipe them out. But when it comes to the distant land is not your land, it's just more for safety. And if it comes to that point where, you know, they come to fight back, okay, fine, you can retreat, but you have to protect your land, therefore you have to wipe out everyone else, and it's yours. If it's it's your house, okay, great, you have to own your house. But if you're going to take over, like, the house across the street, it's not really yours, it's just a safety net. But if someone comes to attack that house, you're going to back up your house more than your second.
Right, but I think to David's point, like, I'm still not so comfortable with the idea of, like, completely decimating everyone.
Yeah, I heard that, yeah. Back then it was still everyone as much as possible. Loot, take the women, children.
Yeah, but this is, but Benji, this is God. And, like, God is saying that, like, Mishpat Tzedek, like, yes, the entire world might be completely unethical, and yet the Torah says that we have to be more ethical. And we have, like, that's like a pretty big deal. So I think, like, again, I'm not 100% comfortable. That's why the Ramban makes me feel a little bit better. But still, the idea of, like, destroying them is a little bit hard. And again, it's just a question of how does this jive with Pasuk Yud of, like, starting off the Shalom. All right, let's take a look at Pasuk Yud Tech, because I think it gets even murkier when you hit here. So anybody that's ever made an upsharing, they know this pasuk. I never liked it as the source for upsharing. I found it very uncomfortable, even though somewhat against my will, Ozzy had an upsharing. I would have been happy to get a haircut right away, but Malki won and beat me to it because she asked my grandfather, like, a few years before he died, like, did you have an upsharing? And she's like, you see, he had one. I was like, all right. Okay, ki tatzur el ir yamim ravim. So what happens when you go, it's not a quick siege. Sometimes it's really quick. The people come out after a couple weeks and they're like, all right, we surrender. But what happens if it lasts a long time? So lo tashchid eitzal in doach alav garzen, kimenu tolo tichro. You cannot destroy the trees because you're going to eat them. So don't cut them down. Because man is like the tree of the land. I think it's Ibn Ezra that explains that basically as that unlike man that you kill because there's no value to them, the trees have value. They feed people. Like, all right, that could work. So just to, like, put this in perspective, I'm told that there's a city, and I'm going to completely decimate them, right? Nobody lives. You're going to kill babies. But God forbid you're going to cut down that apple tree, because there are apples there. Ki Adam eats a sadeh. Right? Imagine teaching this to someone and being like, so this is our holy Bible. Right? We really have our ethics in order. So what in the world is that pasuk talking about? Rak eitz asher teidaki lo eitz machal hu oto tashchi. But you can destroy it if it's just a wood tree, right? Like, I don't know, an elm, a maple, a sycamore, any of those tree streets, those are fine. But apple, peach, whatever, that you can't do. The karata ubanita matzor al ir asher hi osaimach milchama ad ridita. And you're going to lay siege, so whatever you need, find other trees to create your battering rams and your whatever you need, use that, but don't take care of a fruit tree. Okay, all right, that's a tough one. And then the very next parasha is Egla Rufa. Now I was going to actually put all 9 psukim of Egla Rufa there, but we would have needed a second page. Wasn't worth it, because we don't really need the first 4 psukim. But what happens? You have a dead body that's found, right? There's a dead body, you don't know who killed it, and it's out in the highway, out on the road. So what happens? You call out the Kohen, get the Levi, and they're the ones that bless God. What they do is they measure, right? You bring the Sanhedrin, bless you, they measure out to the closest city. Whatever the closest city is, it's on their dime. And then what happens? They all come out. The Ziknei Ha'ir come, and they take this Egla, this calf, and they chop its neck, and then they wash their hands with the egla rufa in a wadi, right, in a dry space. The anuvi amru, and they announce and they say, Yadeinu shafu et adam hazeh veineinu lo ra'u. We did not spill any blood. Our eyes didn't see it. So Rashi then says, oh, of course. He's quoting the Gemara in Sotah, says, of course. They didn't. Nobody thinks they did that. But what they're saying is, it's possible that this person came into our protection and we didn't take care of the person properly. So, like, this is in direct contrast to, like, the philosophy of Stoem of, you come into my property, I purposely ignore you, and we leave you on your own. It's the exact opposite. How could it be that a human being came in our midst and we didn't take care of them? That's what we say. God, please forgive us. We're sorry. So what do? We end off the same way we started. Rashi's point at the beginning was Mishpat Tzedek, and we end off by saying, we hope that we are able to what? We want to do that which is just, that which is good in the eyes of God. I believe so. So, right. So, it's just amazing. We start off with Mishpat Tzedek. We go to Ki Tikrav Elir B'Shalom. And then we end off the the value of a fruit tree. It gives life. It gives sustenance. And then we end off even further. The end is, right? Yadeinu lo shafchu et adam hazeh. We don't want to ever have blood on our hands, and yet what?
Jewish blood.
Right, I suppose. Right, but yet lo techayek kol neshama. We say we care. Human life matters. It's so important. Lo techayek kol neshama. So how do we understand that? So I'll share with you two answers. I think they are both amazing. The first one is of a Riskin. So he says, only that which gives life to society. Actually, I'm going to rephrase that. I'm going to share with you two answers. I'm not so... Usually, I love Rabbi Riskin. This is an answer I'm going to share with you, but I have to tell you that as I was writing it, I wasn't 100% comfortable with it. And you could tell me that you're comfortable with it, you love it, you can tell me you don't love it, but I myself, I wasn't 100% comfortable with it. So what does he say? He says, why are the trees and lo techayek kol neshama back to back? He says, only that which gives life to society, the trees, do we care about. But people that are steeped in hate, who want to destroy society, we can't allow them to live. That's his idea. So he's saying that if you have a culture that's antithetical to the just society that we want, that society, those people, they're not worth living. They're not human, and therefore they have to die. So yes, we view that with Amalek, which again, I'm not comfortable with. Also, to me, I chalk up Amalek as a hoax. I'm much more comfortable saying, like, God told me to do that. If I was a soldier, I'd have to do that. But it's not the same thing as the Israeli soldier in a foxhole who's shooting at the Arab soldier in a foxhole across the way, where he says, he wants to kill me, I have to kill him. Right? That I could, like, that's war. But Amalek is, the Jewish people go into Amalek, that's what Shaul does, and they basically attack them and kill all men, women, and children. Not comfortable with it, doesn't feel so good. But the idea that you're saying that certain people are not human, and therefore they don't deserve to live, so lo techayek kol neshama, as opposed to the fruit tree. Yeah, right? Like, if you, all the stuff that you read about the Holocaust is like, you know, when you read Reflections of the Holocaust, it was, you know, the Nazi soldier was so sweet and so kind to his dog. But yet, I was not worth anything. So to me, I read that, and I understand where Rabbi Riskin is coming from, and he, you know, he talks about like the jihadi people that you're going to meet, and he says that's a person that doesn't deserve to live. But again,
that's the people.
Right.
Us.
Right.
Don't forget that
but
the jihadi, the women are more radical than the men.
The women are more
radical than the men, by far.
I don't know, but I'll
say that. Huh? Why do you say that?
Why do I say that? Look at the women who are up on the Temple Mount who will sit there and run up to people and scream and attack them for moving their lips.
Because they are utilized by all of those forces that being the easiest way to penetrate, not because they're more dangerous.
It's also very small. So are there radical women?
Sometimes they carry their small children with them. They're even more so.
Right. So.
But that's your men, women, and children.
Right. So Rabbi Riskin starts off with that, which, again, I don't love. But then he quotes the Nitziv. I couldn't find the Nitziv inside, so this is his take on the Nitziv. So this might be really Rabbi Riskin 2.0, but I am much more comfortable with the second answer, and I think his second answer really is spot on. He says, Lo techayeh kol neshama. What does that apply to? He says, let's accept the Ramban's opinion. So the Ramban says that b'milchemes mitzvah, I go to the local population as the Jewish people come in, we reach out to them in peace. Let's say they were to say, yes, we're happy to make a peace treaty with you. They pay their taxes. What happens if they don't do that? So who do you have to kill? So the Nitziv says, when it says you have to kill men, women, and children, it's not all men, women, and children. It's whoever goes out to battle with you. So if I go out to war, and their men go out to war, then that's who I have to kill. But if their women and their children join in war, he says, then at that point in time, those people are no longer considered innocent. So he says, when we say lo t'chayeh kol neshama, those are the people that are not innocent. We don't go and kill in cold blood, but we kill innocent civilians. But we kill those people that do what? That participate in war. So this is where he takes it, I assume this is one step further than the Nitziv goes. But he says, what do you do when you have a group of people that go out to war, but they use women and children as their human shields? So he talks about the head of Hamas at the time. I think he might have been blown up since. But he talks about him and saying, you know, he would walk around, and who were his bodyguards? He never went anywhere without five children. Why? Because he always felt, if I have bodyguards, what are they going to do? Israel's going to drop, right, like some massive bomb on top of me, and I'm going to be blown up. But if I have five kids with me, they'll never watch it. They'll never be able to take me out. He says that person, once those children, once those women become accomplices in war, so at that point in time, they're no longer innocent.
So regardless of whether they have a choice in their mouths.
So that's a good question.
Or they know.
Right, that's a good
question. Well, that's the risk.
Right, so
or, even if they know, if they don't have a choice, you're told either walk.
Right, so it seems to me that, like, more, like, I don't want to generalize, but it seems more often than not, the children that don't want to be surrounding those people are at home. The children that are, I mean, I remember spending Shabbos in Chevron, and, like, I mean, there are, like, kids there that go out of their way to, like, start up with the Israeli soldiers, because they know, like, what happens? They throw a rock. The Israeli, you know, soldier turns and faces, you know, them with his M16. And then what happens? Or selfie, right? And it goes like, the social media was crazy. Like, these Israeli occupiers and how terrible it is and whatever. But that's his perspective on it. But what I think is fascinating is that, at least to me, what does that do? That completely reframes these psukim. Hashem is not telling us, go in and destroy the entire nation, men, women, and children. It sounds awful, but rather what's he saying? God is saying, go in and make peace. What if they don't make peace? Well, then kill only those people that you have to kill. Yeah. What do you mean?
Oh, it's kind of a
word. It's like every person. It doesn't say participants.
So.
But we're still saying you kill all the men.
You're still right. You're still killing all the men. Because those are presumably the ones that are going to war with you.
Regardless of whether they're going to war with you.
That's a good question. I don't know. I would love to find the Nitziv inside. It would have made it a lot easier. So I guess it's going back. Let's see. Bayam Shalom. Well, no, because according to the Ramban, Harold, Vimlo Tashli Mimach, right, is that whole part there, right? Meaning you're completely rereading this whole paragraph. According to Rashi, through Tet Vav, is Kain Tasel, Cholarim Rechokot Mimchamot, Shalom Ariya Goyim Ma'ela Heina. Right? So, but it seems like, according to the Ramban, he's saying, no, not necessarily. If they're willing to make peace, then you don't have to kill anyone. So that's by Milchemes Mitzvah. But then by Milchemes Mitzvah, if they don't make peace, you do have to kill everybody. But what's Otechayekol Neshama? Only those people that are involved in war. So that's how he reads it. So I think it's fascinating because at that point in time, it just makes it a much more ethical way of going to battle. I feel a little bit better with that. Chazal, though, point out, and this is really Rashi's quotes, you know, a little bit at the beginning, Al terachim aleihem ki lo yirachmu alecha. Chazal tell us that it's really important that you should not have rachmanus on cruel people, because if you end up having rachmanus on cruel people, in the end, you'll be cruel to those people that deserve your mercy. And that's really how Rabbi Riskin ends his article. He says that at the end of the day, the Jewish army, it is very complex. And how you decide who to kill and not to kill, it becomes a very tough ethical battle. And he goes, on the one hand, I'm super proud of the Israeli army that there are times where they restrain themselves. But he goes, sometimes their restraint ends up being to the detriment of everybody else. And so he says that with all that, he's so torn by what is the true ethics of the Jewish army. What I would say is, to me, that's the complex nature of the Jewish army, is that on the one hand, we hold ourselves to higher standard, but on the other hand, we do have to recognize that war is not pretty, and war does have casualties, and sometimes we have to do what's right, even if it doesn't look so good, and even if the PR of it is not so great. But I think that, to me, if you look at it from the perspective of the Nitziv, these psukim do flow a lot more, a lot better, and there seems to be a much better tone than reading it without the Nitziv. Halavai, halavai, that the words of Yeshaya should come true, that lo yisagoy al goy charev, that the nations of the world will decide that there's no reason for war, and the true calling of the UN will be that we'll turn our swords into plowshares. That's what we hope. But until then, the Jewish people have to hold themselves to this high standard and yet deal with the complexity of being an ethical army.